HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.
Okay, so today I am joined by Dr. Colm Foster. Colm is the Director of Executive Education at the Irish Management Institute. Colm is here to talk to us today about the future of work. Colm, how are you today?
I'm really well, Declan. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for asking. Colm, it's a hot topic at the moment for obvious reasons. Things are changing dramatically out there in the working world. For you, what do you see? What is the future of work?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think there it probably would be a mistake to think that the unstoppable trends are significantly different than they had been probably 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago. The kind of stuff that we've been seeing, the kind of pace of change, the influx of technology, the influx of different demographics in the workplace, all of these things were unstoppable trends, and they will continue irrespective of COVID. I think what we've seen is an acceleration of those trends, not necessarily completely different things happening, but an acceleration of those trends in terms of what people expect from work, in terms of how work will get done in the future. And not just on communication platforms, but we've seen technology leap forward. We've also seen, and hopefully this will be a positive, I think we're seeing a realization that there is a very big difference between essential work and work that is merely well paid. And when we went through that crisis and we realized the kinds of people and the kinds of workers that were actually essential to making the economy and society run, and those of us who are well paid but whose work doesn't fit in as essential, I think that's a very interesting reflection point that hopefully we will think about in terms of how those people in those jobs get appropriately rewarded in the future. And obviously the pandemic also produces a very interesting dynamic in terms of how and where work gets done. And that'll be the biggest change, this kind of hybrid working model. A lot of us are talking about this hybrid working model. So we're now in a situation where I think we've adequately demonstrated that work can be done remotely. It could be done back in the office, it could be done in person, but it can be done remotely. So now you have to have an actual conversation and a thoughtful conversation about where and when and how work gets done, because you can't go back to the facile argument that we have to be in person, I have to see people, I have to have people in the office in order for them to be productive and in order for me to be comfortable that they're being productive. That's no longer the case. And it was always a facile argument, but it's demonstrably so now. So I think that the better organizations are having real thoughtful conversations now about where people do work, when they come in, what kinds of work can they do at home, what kinds of work would require them to be in the office, and what kinds of people work better at home, and what kind of people work better in the office. And then we of course, one of the other issues, Declan, is that our clients will probably decide a lot of this for us. For most of us who are in some kind of service industry, you know, your clients will dictate how and when and in what kind of formats they want to interact with you. So to a certain extent, some of this is in our hands, but to a certain extent, it's in the hands of our customers and clients.
Yeah, really, really good point. Colm, just one of your first points, it's an acceleration as opposed to, you know, being a major change. Why did leadership in a vast majority of companies need a global pandemic for them to decide that their employees didn't need to be on a certain floor in a certain location 8 hours a day?
It is a fascinating question, and I think partly it's the comfort with the familiar. So there's a certain way that work works. There's a certain way that reward structures are set up. There's a certain way that organization structures, reward recognition, you know, performance management, people management processes, they've kind of been set up. And we've been transitioning, and look, some organizations are way, way ahead of this game, so it's not a truism with everybody. But we've been transitioning from that old command and control, you know, model, and we've kind of set up this post-industrial revolution model that we've kind of, it's probably outlived or outgrown its usefulness, certainly in the fourth industrial revolution, certainly in the knowledge-based economy, and with mobile talent and you know, people and our staff are the new talent, particularly the younger talent and more diverse talent that we're bringing into organizations. They look for different things. They're beginning to demand different things of us. So as leaders, we'd be beginning to respond to that, think about, well, maybe there's another way to look at these things. But there is that problem with the unfamiliar, the problem with the risk, the problem with change, the problem with resistance to change and organizational inertia. All of those things they're difficult to overcome. And in fairness to organizations, they are difficult to overcome, particularly if you're in a large organization or if you're in an organization with a lot of tenure or a lot of tenured folks. Organizational memory and organizational politics and organizational power, those are difficult things to shift. So maybe it does need a catalyst, and much and all, as the pandemic has been a huge public health tragedy and human tragedy, you know, for long-term organizational performance, maybe there are some good things we can take out of it, in that it possibly catalyzed better better conversations about the how and the where of work. In our own industry, in the kind of the leadership development learning industry, this idea of learning in the flow of work, well, it was always a great idea. Now it's much more prevalent, much more, it's gaining much more traction. And then that's a real positive. So you can put a lot down to just inertia, just the human factors of inertia and risk avoidance. But it wouldn't be fair to say that of all organizations.
No, totally agree. And absolutely, it was a generalization. I think it's fair to say most organizations will be on that journey. If they haven't already started with it, they've probably missed the boat slightly. But in terms of, you know, they'll start talking about impact instead of presenteeism as a really simple way of doing it. And that will, again, be a major change for a lot of organizations. Is there anything you're seeing in your world as to how companies are making that transition?
Yeah, I think that, and again, this is something that better organizations have been up for a long time. As you say, this idea of presenteeism, of having to watch people and stand over people and micromanage, is an idea that should have died long ago. And God, it's losing traction. There are vestiges. It's a bit like the sting of a dying wasp. You know, there are vestiges of that. Like there is software that will track keyboard strokes. There is software that will track people's, how much time they're spending online and what they're doing online. That's the wrong answer. That's I think going down that route is just hanging on to a vestige of the past. So we're beginning to see the more thoughtful managers think about, well, how would you know? Genuinely, if I can't watch these people, well, how would I know they're doing a good job? What would be the proxy? What's the measure? What's the metric? What's the KPI? Collecting that information is the easy part. It's mechanical. Like, once you figure out, as we have all done, once you figure out what the KPI is, that's the hard intellectual lift. Some managers and leaders are being much more thoughtful now, but how would I genuinely know that? And then organizations are adopting various different technologies to enact that and to collect that data and what have you. That is what we certainly don't have a shortage of in the new world, is data. Yeah. It's picking the right pieces of data has always been the challenge. And the people who will succeed are the people who are thoughtful about that. And it's a bit like competitive advantage. There is no template. And luckily for those people who figure it out, it's not a template. So you do get a competitive advantage with doing the hard work of figuring out what are the success factors for you and for your people. Because it's unlikely to be copyable. It's probably going to be unique to you, which is, you know, a tremendous competitive advantage, but will be difficult. And what it does require, and this is a very old idea, the military used to talk about, you know, thinking two levels up and looking two levels down. So where you're at, in wherever you sit in the organization, what's important to your boss and what's important to her boss? So, you know, look up two levels in the organization and see, well, where does my bit fit in? And how would I convince those people that I'm doing a good job? And then look two levels down. But what does that require me to ask of the next level? And what would they be asking of their next level down? So can I see through the organization? How would I know this is all working? So you see yourself as part of a chain. Obviously, it's a hierarchical description of organizations that may no longer be valid. But that idea of seeing two levels up, whether that's in a time frame or whether that's an organization structure, and looking two levels down into, you know, two levels of granularity below you, thinking in those terms really helps people to get a good answer to, well, what should I be looking for here?
Really interesting. Yeah, I haven't heard that analogy before, so very, very interesting. You touched on something as well. This is why I love doing this podcast, because I get to talk to people far more intelligent than me about these things. But you were talking about in the context of where people work, that it might be different people will have different preferences. How will companies ensure that each of their employees, or will they, that each of their employees are experiencing the same culture? And my follow-up sort of question to that will be, how will they then eliminate things like, you know, biases towards presenteeism with certain managers and stuff like that?
But yeah, I mean, the cultural one is a brilliant question, Declan. And I think that's going to be, in terms of like a new leadership competence, how you build culture in a hybrid organization is going to be really interesting. Like building culture and creating culture in a virtual organization is actually not that difficult, because we've just come through 18 months when some people have really strengthened their culture and the psychological contract is in rude health. There are organizations for whom that is not true, but there are some organizations who figured that out. It's much more tricky when it's hybrid. So, and as you say, there are some people and managers do have that recency or that availability or that confirmation bias where, you know, if you're in the office and there are other people in the office, you tend to think that those people are working and making the right life choices and right decisions and are committed to the organization. And if you're in the office and people aren't, you know, they don't look like you, they don't act like you, they don't seem to have the same values or the same orientation to work as you because they've made a different choice, which questions your choice. We don't like having our choices questioned. It creates that kind of dissonance. So you question their commitment rather than questioning your own. So getting that balance right when you have hybrid work is going to be the real key. And things like, how do you create shared stories? How do you create shared rituals when not everybody's in the office? How do you create shared experiences? Things like onboarding and all those kind of things. That's going to be fascinating when you have that hybrid model. I mean, that's going to be one to crack. But sure, look, people who've been leading global teams have been at this for years. This is not a new problem. So if you're sitting in, you know, Sandyford and you've got an office in Santa Clara and you've got people working in Chennai, you've been doing this. You know, the global organizations have had to deal with this issue for years. So there are ways of getting around it. I think one of the things for me, and I'm just, again, it might just be a generational thing for people of a certain age tend to believe this, but I think it is true about people, that you do need to get people together. You do need to get people physically together from time to time. Whatever model you have, people need to come together. They need to break bread. They need to share stories. They need to have a laugh. They need to, do you remember the time when, you know, we couldn't get the taxi home and we were all stood there? You know, then people need to share that kind of stuff. Then they can kind of scatter to the four winds and work virtually, and, you know, from time to time. But I think that there's an irreplaceable and irreducible level of human contact. So that the better organizations and global teams do this. So hybrid models will do this, will bring people together for meaningful interaction, not just so we can all sit working on our, you know, sit with headphones on in the same place. That's not what I'm talking about. We'll bring people together to meaningful interact. So that idea of creating culture, hugely, hugely important. And particularly from a HR perspective, identifying, nurturing and managing talent that is remote, and make, because there will be that FOMO, you know, fear of missing out on the promotion. Or the choice project, or the, you know, the good work, because you're just not around when the out of our office and goes, is there somebody here who can help me with this problem? You won't be there and somebody else will. So that can create a pattern of behavior that won't be useful. So I think that particularly for HR professionals is understanding, how does talent get spotlighted? How does talent get identified? How does talent get protected and nurtured when that talent has made the choice for herself and for the organization that person is more productive working in it to a different rhythm or a different cadence, but to get over the natural human tendency, just that the similarity attraction paradigm, that natural tendency to see people who make the choices that we make as good and valuable and committed people. So one of the things I absolutely say is critical, which comes back to kind of parent politics in an organization, is if we're going to have a hybrid model and if you're going to have a certain amount of blended work, the powerful people in the organization, usually the senior people, they have to be making that choice. It can't be for junior people or for people who aren't, you know, committed or aren't on a career track. You know, the progressive, bright young things, those people have to see that there are role models, powerful people in the organization making these kinds of choices. So what we role model, what we, particularly the senior people, there's a lot of pressure on senior people to role model the right kinds of things. And that's going to include hybrid working. It's instructive. If you've ever been in one of these kind of Zoom meetings, you know, with lots of people around the world, they work really well if the boss is on Zoom. If the boss is in the building and everybody else is on Zoom, they don't work so well. So where power sits, where power resides, and how powerful people use and leverage that power, because like power hasn't gone away. The virtual world, the physical world, power still matters. Politics still matters. influence still matters, presence still matters. So how those people, how leaders role model that behavior and the choices that the leaders make about the kinds of, you know, how they interact with work and how they schedule themselves and all that kind of stuff, that's going to be hugely instructive. And if the leaders get that wrong, and this is just something that the hybrid model is something that other people do, it's not going to work.
Yeah, so the classic action speaking louder than words almost for the leaders. Where do you see, I know there'll be no one size fits all, because I mean, if you're in retail, whatever that looks like in 10 years, or if you're in, as you say, our clients might dictate part of this. But for the average knowledge-based office, inverted commas, worker, where do you think it sits in, or where do you think it will be in 10 years? What do you think it will look like? Or would you be reluctant to speculate?
You know, it would just be a speculation. It'll probably look like nothing that we can conceptualize. And I'm kind of hoping that that's the case. It's a bit like when you're, you know, if you have kids in college, the jobs that your kids are going to do don't exist. So if you're trying to give advice to kids in college about what jobs they do, what careers they should be going into, the really good jobs in 10 years' time that don't exist now, and the really good organizations like the FTSE 500 is much more malleable than it's ever been, and that's going to continue. So that, you know, the big organizations are will be new and will be invented, and they'll live and die and blossom much quicker. You'll see a flourishing of organizations and a closing down of organizations much quicker than it has in the past, and probably won't have the same sustainability or durability in organizations. So very different kinds of business models, service-based industries, probably, you know, knowledge-based industries, particularly in the developed world. I think that's again, an unstoppable, inevitable trend. And then the growth of an integration between machine learning, human learning, human capability, machine capability. That's that artificial intelligence revolution. That's another unstoppable trend. 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, we would have been saying this about computers. You know, computers are the thing, you know, and now, sure, how can you imagine your life without them? And they haven't replaced humans. They've enhanced human capability. So I think the same thing will happen. It's just going to happen very fast. But in terms of how people work, like this idea of, and certainly this idea of people sitting in traffic for 45 minutes to sit in an office for 8 or 9 or 10 hours and then to, you know, sit in traffic for 45 minutes again at the end of the day, I don't think that's going to be happening, certainly not 5 days a week for many people. Although there will be a rush. I'm sure you're the same, Declan. I can't wait to get back into an office and be around people and bump the people.
Yeah.
You know, I miss queuing for coffee. You know, I miss queuing in our canteen for coffee and chatting to people while I queue for coffee. I used to hate having to queue for coffee. I'll complain, why can't we have 3 more coffee machines? You know, now, in the queue. So there's going to be a rush back into offices, and then we're going to realize why we hated it, and there'll be a rush back in. So it'll, you know, the pendulum will swing and it'll settle back down. And I think we will have a more intelligent, evolved, blended model in probably 6 or 12 or 9 months time. And then that over time, that will then settle into, there will be those people for whom working from home is the right answer for the kinds of work they do. And to be those people who are much more social, and just, even if I'm working on stuff on my own, I need to be around other people while I'm doing. And those people will be, and that's kind of the co-working kind of office, co-working space. Those kind of places will evolve for those people. I think for most human beings, being on your own in your kitchen all day long while you're working, probably not a great idea. So I think that even if you're the solitary person, or even if you do work that just requires peace and quiet, and if you're pretty introverted, there will still be a need for you to interact socially at some level. So some kind of a hybrid. Well, for pretty much everybody.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an appetite there for people to have that social interaction, if nothing else. I do find it amazing when you hear organizations talking about, you will be in the office X amount of time. You know, that's their version of hybrid with no predefined reason to be there other than to be present. I find that thinking a bit dated.
Yeah, it's kind of a medieval way to manage people. It's effective in short term. It's a bit like fear. You know, that kind of micromanagement and fear-based management, and we used to call it Theory X. Remember in the old days, you called this Theory X. It certainly works in short bursts, and what you can do is get people to comply. You just kind of get them to be creative or positive or engaging or innovative. You can't get them to comply with stuff. So if that's all you need, knock yourself out. But if you're looking for a discretionary effort from talented people who have options, they're just going to vote with their feet.
I was about to say it's not the best retention strategy, that's for sure.
Not
in terms of keeping people.
Well, there was a lovely statistic there, and I forget where I read this. I think it was a Deloitte study based in the States, that 30% of US employees will leave their employer if they don't have some kind of blended option. if they're not offered some kind of blended option when it's available. Now there's about 60 or 70% of people wanted some kind of blended option, but as much as I think it was 30% of employees will walk if they don't have some, if blend is not somewhere in the mix. I'm not sure if it would be as high in Ireland, but it's an interesting statistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd say it would. I'm sure it's echoed at some level, definitely in Ireland. But to the point, though, I think there absolutely office still has a place. I think going to an office should be for a reason. And even if that reason is the social bit, the queuing for coffee with your team and, you know, creating those opportunities to collaborate. Touch on technology and the part it's played previously, and we all thought that at this stage some version of Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator would be doing our jobs by now, which hasn't happened. What's it looking like in terms of trends? And I appreciate you said we probably can't conceptualize it just yet, but in terms of skill set, is there any stuff that's always going to be needed, or is there any emerging ones that you feel will be in hot demand in 5 years time or 10 years time or whatever it might be?
I think there's an irreducible human level. There's this kind of human intuition. There's the ability to understand, engage with other humans on a human level. I think any jobs that require humans to interact with each other, I don't think can be reduced. I think we've all had the interactions with the chatbots and the robots, and it's all very cute and funny, but it's not. There is something kind of magical that's missing. I don't think that can be replaced, no matter how smart the robots get, no matter how smart the intelligence gets. It can only be it can be as intelligent as it's probably going to be, and then it can learn. And so machine learning is probably where the advantage is. But I think there are certain jobs, particularly creative, the kind of compassion-based, the empathy-based jobs. But there are some jobs that are more kind of knowledge-based. Again, I think there was a statistic about the chances in the next 10 years of your job. And I think there is an index. There's an artificial intelligenceable index or a machine learning index that speaks to the extent to which your job could be automated. And for bookkeepers in the next 10 years, I think it's 97% chance that job will be automated. So if what you do is move paper, you know, reconcile numbers, that's a job that can be automated. If your job involves making intuitive leaps about what those numbers say, or making connections or interesting connections about what those numbers mean, that's something that probably can't be learned. If your job involves taking those numbers and going to convince somebody to take an action based on what the numbers say, I don't think that's the kind of thing that could be automated necessarily. So that the raw data compilation collection stuff, that kind of data management stuff, if that's those jobs, I think are automatable relatively easily even today, and you can visit to that. But the piece that does the creative interpretation, I think that's much more difficult. And will take much longer. And then there's a piece about the influencing, persuasion, leading, you know, in human interaction piece. Like, I can't quite yet get my head around how that's going to get automated. And I would be minded my own background in emotional intelligence, I'd be minded to think that it can't be. We're doing things today that were unthinkable 5 years ago. So I think we'll keep an open mind. I think the skills, the new skills are critical inquiry. It's skepticism, informed skepticism, the ability to engage with vast quantities of data and adopt a critical, inquiring, curious attitude to that and see connections and make connections. That's always going to be valuable. It was a bit like in the old days, if you managed to find the report, like you were a genius if you managed to find the report. So the skills were find the report. Now anybody can just Google the report. Now the skill is reading the report, and the machines are now being taught to read the report. So the skill moves on to interpreting what that means, you know, making connections based on what that means. So we'll be a step ahead of Arnold for a while yet.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, it is interesting though, even with current sort of robotic process automation, you can, anything that you can put a parameter on, you know, do X to Y or whatever, or move it from here to there, then, you know, that's already automatable, albeit not easily slow in terms of the tech. Well, easily so, just maybe not cheaply at the moment. Calm, I'm conscious of your time. One last question, if you don't mind. The leadership obviously is an area close to your own heart. What if that skill set, I mean, you mentioned critical inquiry, etc. What other skill sets do you think leaders will need in the coming years?
Do you know what a lot of what we talked about in for the last while, Declan, but I think if one other thing I would put in, the kinds of work, the way that work shows up is changing. So how you lead people is situationally contingent. So it's situationally contingent on three factors: you, the person you're leading, and the situation you find yourself in. So, you know, how you lead and what's right for you, that'll be different. The kind of leadership that the people around you need from you, that will change from time to time and from person to person. And then the situation will call, you know, the context you find yourself in will call for different things. So, you know, we'll less reliance on hierarchy. You'll more be dealing with fluid teams. So your ability to lead, to very quickly establish rapport, very quickly establish your credibility, because you know, you don't have years to build a relationship with folk. You'll probably have days or weeks, and then they'll move on and be other people. And then you might be a leader, you might be a follower. So that agility to connect quickly with people, that's going to be very important. And for you to switch roles and to lead and follow sometimes at the same time, to build trust, to build autonomy in people, that again, that where you don't have control over them. So that old days of that kind of reward and punishment mechanisms, those they're long gone, thank God, they're in the bin. So building trust, allowing people to use their space, giving people autonomy, empowering people, that's going to be more important. There's a move from beginning of the deck, and I think this has been going on for years, but there's a move from that pure profit base, the kind of the shareholder view of the world, the kind of shareholder value view of the world, the kind of even economic profit view of the world, into a more social enterprise, a more connected, a more holistic view. It sounds a bit hippie, but I think the organizations of the future will be much more connected to the planet, much more connected to, you know, people, profit, and planet. That's the triple bottom line. Again, that idea has been around for 30 or 40 years. People 30 years ago were talking about triple bottom lines, but not many of them. But now it's much more common. So leaders of the future will have to, you can't just be good at the financy bit, or you can't just be good at the marketing bit, you can't just be good at the technology bit. You need to see what you're doing in the context of a broader purpose. And hopefully, because we all pretty much had a common purpose, there's been a huge dividend in organizations of getting people all on the same page. And some organizations have had a really good experience, like dealing with a horrible context, but a really good experience of having everybody focused on the same thing and feeling what it's like to have everybody focused on the same thing. When all the petty stuff fell away, because there was a real crisis to deal with, there was a real problem to be dealt with, not just in organizations, but in society. So that's something that we've tantalizingly had a glimpse of. What's it like when you get everybody on the same page? And if we could repeat that without having to have the crisis, if you could repeat that and get people really, you know, if the leadership in the organization could get people really fired up around a common purpose and energized and engaged around a common purpose, and finding that nugget that genuinely binds people together, so we can repeat that cohesiveness that some organizations manage to achieve. And again, not all, but some organizations manage to really gel a workforce around surviving, and that sense of gelling and purpose and coming together and collegiality and, you know, cooperation, collaboration. There's a golden nugget in there, and once you've tasted it and had that tantalizing glimpse of how powerful your organization could be when everybody really gels together, that's a thing that great leaders are going to be doing in the future. And the organizations that win are going to be the organizations that do that. Organizations who slip back into, we're now back in our comfort zone, so we can go back into our silos and, you know, start refighting the battles that we've been fighting for years, those organizations are going to get outlearned and outcompeted.
And I presume to actually make that happen, Colm, that you need like everything end to end within the organization on that. Like, you need behaviors support your purpose to be rewarded. You need your talent acquisition team only recruiting people who have that purpose in their DNA. That's a very much a, you know, you really need everyone bought into it, and making that happen, I'm guessing, is the tricky bit.
Well, there's a really interesting paradox, because you're absolutely right. You do need people bought in, but actually you need to do that in a way that embraces diversity and inclusion. And this is one of the tricks, and this is the hardest part with diversity and inclusion, because diversity and inclusion is not about having people who look different on the outside. That's kind of the easy part of it. If we all buy into one paradigm, it doesn't matter, you know, what we look like on the outside, but if our internal schema, if our internal paradigm, if the business model to which we all subscribe is the same, we are actually all the same person where it matters. So we have no diversity. There's no question of inclusion, because we're not even diverse in the first place. So getting very different people, getting people with different attitudes, getting people with different ways of working, again, just, you know, who wants to work in the office and who doesn't, who enjoys it? That's just a microcosm of it. So getting that diversity leveraged, getting real inclusion, having different ideas, having competition of ideas, not competition of people, having competition of business models, not competition of ideologies, that, you know, we get that part right. So we can cohere a group of disparate voices. It's a bit like having it's like an orchestra, you know, it's a, maybe a little bit of a cheesy cliche, but you know, it, all the pieces are different. They all have different roles. They all sound different, but the skill is getting them all to blend into a symphony. And that's kind of what a great organization will do. We'll be blending all that difference rather than having, there's no point having everybody playing the same instrument. You know, that's not going to produce a harmonious sound. You want different instruments, different roles, different tasks, different perspectives, you know, different abilities, different attitudes, all that kind of stuff. When that's blended together, I think that's when organizations will really succeed, which is the great task. You know, this is the task of leadership in the 21st century.
Fantastic. Colm, thanks for joining us today. If people want to examine their own leadership and develop their capabilities, obviously the IMI is a, you know, globally ranked executive education organization. What's the best way to interact with the IMI?
IMI.ie on our website. We have a really good list of either graduate studies programs. If you want to do it, go through a master's level program, a level 9 level program. We have a great number of offerings there. We have a really interesting suite now of short programs from 2 days to 3 days. And then we are very happy to work with, and we do work with some of the biggest organizations in the country on to produce customized, tailored solutions for those people. If you have a particular need, interact with us through the website. We're very happy to talk to you. And we also have two or 300 of Ireland's leading organizations members. We're a membership organization, so it's possible to become a member of IMI and then access a whole range of really interesting thought leadership content. You know, we curate content from the best around the world, so you don't have to worry about where the best idea is. We do all of that. Come to us and we'll have curated all the best ideas for you. So either as a long program or a short program or in the customized world, we'd be delighted to talk to you. So yeah, imi.ie, to contact us through the website.
Brilliant. Colm, thanks for your time.
Not a problem, Declan. Thank you.
HRHeadquarters.ie, the podcast.